Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. From work to entertainment to social media, artificial intelligence is now everywhere, and it's touching almost all aspects of our lives in one way or another. And as the capabilities of AI systems have increased dramatically, so has general interest in their development. AI has become easily accessible, easy to use, and for many people, it's a useful tool. As a result, AI is being used by individuals and institutions to help solve a variety of challenges, from everyday decision-making to pressing global issues. At the same time, however, many commentators and policymakers have expressed concerns about the effects of AI on society, politics, and the economy. To highlight these concerns, in 2025, The Ballpark launched a mini-series on AI in the United States, focused on its potential impacts on society both today and looking into the future. So far, we've interviewed scholars on a range of AI-related topics such as deepfakes, disinformation, automation in the workplace, and the competition between the US and China over AI development. This year, we're continuing our AI mini-series by diving deeper into the socioeconomic consequences of AI usage. Our upcoming episodes will include conversations with experts about AI in the gig economy, the public governance of artificial intelligence, AI and fact-checking, and more. For our first episode on AI this year, I spoke with Professor Chinmay Sharma about how and why AI can cause harm, issues of responsibility and accountability in AI usage, and AI's relationship with cybersecurity. Professor Chinmay Sharma is an associate professor at Fordham Law School and a research affiliate at the Institute for Law and AI. I began by asking Professor Sharma to outline her research and current work.
My name is Chinmay Sharma. I am an associate professor at Fordham Law School, where I've been for about 3 years. I am a law and technology scholar, and right now I'm joined the kind of many other scholars in the legal field and in other fields that seem to be very preoccupied with artificial intelligence. And so while my scholarship doesn't focus entirely or exclusively on artificial intelligence, right now, I've been thinking through a lot of the ways in which these systems are designed, who's designing them, the way they're being introduced into society, what they're being used for, how that's kind of impacting things we've taken for granted. The project I'm working on right now is what happens to foundational rule of law principles if the executive branch of the government is using artificial intelligence to do work that previously human civil servants would do.
Thanks. We'll definitely get into that a bit later on. So just to start things off, you've written about how AI can cause harm. And I think for a lot of our listeners, it might be hard to imagine that those that build and work on AI, those who develop it, are intending it to do so, to do harm. So maybe this is happening as kind of an accident or a byproduct. Why is it happening?
You know, it's funny. I think that it's a phenomenon that is familiar in parenting between siblings and friends, romantic relationships, professional relationships, where it's never that somebody is evil and intending to cause a large amount of harm. It's that they either misjudge how something's going to be received, underestimate how harmful something they do, basically just an incorrect risk evaluation, or discount how important a particular type of harm is. So it's irrational that you feel this way. And so you're overreacting. And how does that apply to technology? For decades and decades, we have applied, I think, a different threshold to tech about how much risk is acceptable before something can enter the marketplace or society. It's interesting. I'm not a sociologist. I'm not entirely sure how or why this happens, but we would not introduce a new technique of building a bridge that worked really well in betas and is being pitched with really great numbers in a small amount of testing and then say, wow, we've never seen anything like this before. Let's go ahead and build it. Because the only way for us to figure out what's going to happen is for thousands of people to cross it every day. But in tech, I think that at the beginning, we just didn't have the information or the imagination to anticipate what might go wrong. It seemed like a pretty wonderful tool for connecting people across large distances and sharing information. And so I think it's totally understandable that we didn't know exactly what would happen once we had more dynamic content on the internet or larger quantities of it, et cetera. I think after that, we were so enthralled with what tech can provide that we were willing to accept more harm than we maybe would in other contexts. We didn't want to kind of restrict the advancement. And so we kind of discounted or underestimated how bad things could be. We were just like, surely the benefits outweigh the costs. And now at this point, I think the fight is less how big are the harms and more which harms should count. We're definitely still having the conversation around how big are the harms and people disagree, but a lot of the conversations on which harms count. How measurable do they have to be? How much data do you need to have for us to be able to say, no, this is definitely harmful? Discriminatory effect, sycophancy, bias, ideological influence. All of these things are not things that, for example, the law traditionally recognizes as compensable harms. They're not ones we talk about, but that seems to be where the fight is. I think that tech is this unique field where the thumb is on the scale of wanting more of it or not wanting to restrict it. And it's now so powerful and complex, not in like spaceships are complex, nuclear energy is complex, complex in that the way it interacts with society implicates so many disciplines, is so hard to measure and observe that we don't really know how to wrap our arms around the harm that it's providing. Or the benefits, but we're spending a lot more time thinking about the benefits than I think we are the harms.
Thank you. And I'm fascinated by the bridge metaphor you've used, which I think for me is really helpful in terms of trying to understand what's happening and who's creating it. So if I found a river and I wanted to build a bridge, I couldn't just build a bridge across a river. I'm not an architect. I'm not a structural engineer. I have no idea about safety or concrete or any other materials. But my sense is that I could build an AI if I wanted to, if I could do a bit of reading up, or I could maybe use another AI to help me build an AI, and then I could release that. And just like a bridge helps people get from A to B, AI might be helpful, but people can also get harmed or similar with AI. So you've been talking about this idea that we're developing, we're releasing AI, but we're also willing to accept more harm. Who is this we? Is it we as a society, or is it the developers? Because they have a certain level of power pushing that line in a way that, for example, if you're building a bridge, you have legal forces, you have bylaws, and just construction codes that stop people like you and I who may not have qualifications from building bridges.
I think the we, the amorphous we, can be defined in a lot of different ways, or the lines can be drawn in different ways. I think that we, as in the tech community, I was a software developer, not AI, iOS app developer for a period of time, and I was in the startup world, and it was overwhelming and felt kind of satirical just how much the culture internalized was almost kind of a caricature of the move fast and break things, of the if you build it, they will come, a la Field of Dreams, where the currency of the land was a very good demo and being able to show 10x growth in user base. And then obviously monetizing, that became how you build a consumer platform. But I was only B2C. So what I was working on were like straight to consumers. There's a whole separate world of enterprise software. And in that tech world, it's not necessarily the same. I mean, now that it very much is the same, but like Oracle was building software with the idea of it's a very pro. They're marketing how to make capitalism more efficient and effective. Let's focus your resources on where you add value. And we're going to use technology to make all of the other stuff that you have to do, but is feels like a waste of time and resources, cheaper and faster and easier and more accurate. So anyway, I think that tech, at one point, there was like a shift. We wanted really high quality products for like the enterprises that were going to try to automate payroll and things like that. And then we were willing to accept really products if they were going straight to consumers. Like if Angry Bird wasn't a great app, but could make a ton of money because of ad placement and was addictive, that's great. That's all we needed. But now we have kind of the panoply of products. The same companies that are building straight for consumers are also building enterprise versions. For example, like these foundation models are going to consumers and they're going to enormous companies to use internally. The other we could be society where I try to, it's embarrassing, but I try to be very open about it to be like, there are more people like me than I think might be honest about it. I use Amazon. Gmail is my primary email provider. I am a tech scholar. I care about privacy. I care about anti-competitive markets. I care about surveillance. I care about all of these things. And yet, if it is available to me and it's buying something off of Amazon for my pets because I ran out of litter, could save me an hour of sleep when I am otherwise underslept. It's a very, very tough thing to forego in the name of principles. And I argue that's not the responsibility of the average consumer. The reason we have regulation is to say, this is bad for society at large, even if it's going to make an individual consumer's life marginally better in the short term. It shouldn't be in the hands of every consumer to have to make this like seemingly impossible choice. So anyway, we collectively do get a lot of value from this. And we collectively as society, as the users of these products, are uniquely poorly positioned to evaluate whether they are high quality, safe and secure, and whether or not they're going to cause harm to us or other people in the long run. We're just not able to do that. And then the other category is regulators. There's lots of reasons. Some might sound more conspiracy theory, but I don't think they are. Politicians, you are not going to win a major election without some money coming from tech. It's just the reality of today. A lot of places have big constituents that are these tech companies. So there are reasons why, just on policy alone, there are risks to taking certain kinds of positions. But then there's who has the money to lobby, who has the money to put out studies, who has the money to take the measurements that can make the compelling case that something is or is not safe. That the regulatory capture concern is just, that feels a foregone conclusion in the tech space, in my opinion. And then there's kind of like Western culture. I don't think that every part of the world interacts with technology companies in the same way. We have a lot of Western bias in terms of we have particular forms of governments and we structure markets in particular ways, and tech flourishes in these environments and they face many more barriers in other parts of the world. And so we've made certain kind of decisions, not all Western countries, and there are many non-Western countries that kind of are similar to us. But anyway, just broadly speaking, there's kind of a Western socio-historical, political, cultural approach to this. But I think those are the different we's that have allowed this trend to happen over time.
So in 2024, you wrote a paper called AI's Hippocratic Oath. What would a Hippocratic Oath for AI be? And who do you think should be taking that oath?
So in all candor, I both genuinely believe in the concept of a Hippocratic Oath, and also it was definitely to be a somewhat provocative title for a paper to get at least maybe three more people than the usual six to read it. Both of my parents are physicians. There are many, many actually medical professionals in my family with a very, very strong sense of how doctors felt about the Hippocratic Oath. And not all doctors feel this way, but there are many doctors that feel very strongly that they have a very, 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 very big ethical commitment to do no harm. Now, the Hippocratic Oath is not a contract. It is not a legally binding concept. It is a ethos. It's a vibe. It is something that a profession has said, this is our guiding principle. But do no harm is just, from a lawyer's standpoint, an impracticable rule. Sometimes you have to do harm. Sometimes it's harm minimization. Sometimes it's harm in the short term for long-term gain. Now, if you're a public policy health official, you're going to have to do knowing harm because you have a limited number of vaccines and there's a pandemic and you're going to determine who gets them and who doesn't, who gets the ventilator and who doesn't. So anyway, do no harm is not a hard and fast rule. But I think that even if that's not the case, the fact that you can have such a deeply embedded principle that guides the behavior of a group of people that have an immense amount of power and skill and expertise, and we depend on them so strongly in society, that seemed great. And so what would that look like for AI? I don't know. And the idea of the paper was, we can't possibly know, because right now the biggest influences on what the culture of tech is largely market-based. It's the economics of building these types of products, tools, services, and making money off of them. And professionalization historically has been a kind of a sociological movement that becomes a regulatory movement of saying there are some professions that we are uncomfortable letting just contract power or profit incentives drive what the professionals in those fields do. And to be brief about it, but once upon a time, doctors in the US were not licensed. You did not have to go to medical school necessarily. You did not have to pass a test. You could basically just ask for and get permission to be a physician. over time, there were an enormous number of, they didn't call it malpractice because that didn't exist, but cases of doctors kind of, there's a broken bone, but instead of fixing it, they amputate the arm kind of stories. Doctors in surgery wouldn't wash their hands or wouldn't sterilize their tools. A lot of horrible things were happening. And it's not that the science hadn't caught up. Everybody knew that was very bad. And so doctors started to get sued. It became an existential threat to the profession because juries were so opposed to doctors as, you consider yourself better than us, you charge all this money, and still you're doing a job, that basically juries across the board would hold them liable. So even good doctors would get thrown out with the bad because there was a very strong anti-professional or anti-elite sentiment. So doctors had an internal incentive to organize. And that's when they started to require, they lobbied their own regulators to require licensing for the profession. They put together mandatory curriculum. They actually got rid of many medical schools as not being up to snuff for providing a medical education. So it became a very rigorous system. And over time, what you saw was less cases of physicians being egregiously bad at their jobs. Now, there are a lot of other risks and harms that come from professionalization. So we can talk about those too. I'm not saying it's just like a totally rosy story, but doctors, lawyers, mechanical engineers, civil engineers, electrical engineers, architects, they're licensed professionals. They are beholden to a set of objective standards that cannot be set aside because a boss says, no, what we need to do is this because that's going to be best for the shareholder or for our bottom line.
So coming off of that, do you see it as a possibility or even at all likely that you could see some kind of license or professionalization of AI development? Maybe that you'd need a license to develop AI at a certain level or in a certain way?
The skeptic in me thinks it is very unlikely we will see that sort of self-regulation until we see the sort of lashback against engineers the way that we saw with physicians. And the reason we are unlikely to see that is because when this happened, physicians were not part of the enormous hospital corporations that run an ecosystem of centers in an area. You had the physician that you knew and recognized that treated you, and you can say, my treatment went poorly, it's their fault. And so now it's going to be hard to identify, like medical malpractice came to the show. It's hard to identify exactly who it is. It's not impossible. It happens all the time. It's just more complicated. And with tech, we don't know if engineer A or engineer B made a certain decision. Some of why I argue we should have this is because if each engineer could be on the hook for what their team does, then you'll see more documentation. You'll see a better kind of like what the end-to-end development process looked like, who made decisions, what those decisions were based on. And somebody at the end of the day would be on the hook for all of that. But I don't know that we have the political will or the community organizing power to push for that. I like to think that my cynicism will be proven wrong though, because you have seen a lot of, over the past decade plus, movement around tech workers wanting to organize, engage in collective bargaining, unionize, whether through formal union structures or within a company union structures. You're seeing tech company employees like write public letters, risk getting fired, report to regulators, whistleblow. So there is energy. And I guess like a big thing that I try to underline is just never forget that tech companies are not monoliths. There are many hundreds and hundreds and thousands of engineers, and not just engineers, trust and safety professionals that do not agree with maybe the C-suite of their companies is doing. They might have an intrinsic desire to do their jobs well and to not cause harm with their products, but their executives might not agree. And right now, they don't really have the ability to push back without risking a lot.
And staying on the idea of harm just briefly and thinking about people's everyday use of AI, everything from writing a document to transcribing audio, billions are using this every day. Some may feel they've been harmed in certain ways or it's caused them difficulty. What can anyone do at kind of the basic corporate employee level or just a member of the public who's using an AI tool as part of an email suite or something like that? Should they be doing anything? Is there anything they can do?
I mean, the answer is always yes. I think this is where the optimist in me comes out. I think that as cheesy as it sounds, and maybe it's not just cheesy, it's naive, but I don't think so. I do genuinely believe in the a wave is just a collection of single droplets of water. If you are in a company and something feels wrong, it is risky, and I'm not going to pretend it's not risky, but even just communicating that to one other person is a huge step in saying, I noticed something. Do you notice it too? Because that's the way more people can be brought into the fold. You can at least communicate or signal to somebody else like, hey, even if you don't agree with this one thing, maybe keep your eye out and see if there's anything else weird. Those are tiny things, but those are the things that I think keep us asymptotic with complacency. It's just being able to exercise your critical mind and feeling brave enough to make it a collective thing, even if it's one person or two people. And if you escalate it, even better. The lawyer in me says, document it always. Document everything as much as you can. And that is not legal advice, because you should definitely think about what your employer's contracts say in terms of what you can document. But in a company, there's a lot to do. Cooperating with the media, a lot of what we're finding out about what's happening in tech today is because anonymous sources, anonymous but credible sources, are cooperating with the media to share information internally. 404 Media is an incredible investigative journalism outlet, ProPublica. They've been doing great work exposing things we wouldn't otherwise know if employees within companies didn't take the brave step of sharing something with the media. As regulators, I was going to say, as employees, they should whistleblow. But as regulators, one thing we really need to do is shore up protections for legitimate whistleblowers. It is actually quite hard to get classified as a whistleblower. And therefore, a lot of people that we might think are entitled to those protections, or they might do it thinking they're entitled to those protections, don't actually get those protections. And that's very bad. But then as a member of the general public, that's even harder. I could say, don't use Amazon. But I think that also maintaining critical thought when it comes to these products, kind of coming into it being like, assuming the worst case scenario, what could go wrong here? What could I be missing? What am I not anticipating? Especially as a parent. I mean, I am not a parent, and it terrifies me thinking about what my friends who have kids will have to think through as partners, as more than one person parenting, or just by themselves or with other people, kind of like in the village helping raise a child. What do you do about exposure to not just screens, but social media, AI? Do you involve it in the learning process? Do you not? Do you send your kid to a public school if you know that they have it as a mandatory part of the curriculum? There's a lot of questions there, but I think that in terms of what to do is to keep talking. And then I guess for the people that you might be getting advice from, part of what I get frustrated with, which is why I try to openly admit that even though I'm embarrassed of it, I do want to be honest that I use Amazon or whatever, is that I think that there's a lot of posturing. And when you people are posturing or saying, I never expose my kid to screens, or it would be insane if in today's environment, you are not teaching your two-year-old how to use a cell phone, because then they're going to fall behind and never be able to like keep up in this competitive world. We don't know. And so I think being a little bit more honest, like, I'm not sure, like, this is hard. What did you do? Just kind of embracing the uncertainty might make for better, more productive conversations as like an average member of society. And then from the experts thinking and talking about this, whether in academia, whether within the private sector or in the government, more cross-disciplinary work. I am tired of being in rooms talking about AI with only other legal scholars. I also think that it's equally bad for tech policy to only be a bunch of tech experts in a room. I've brought up sociology more than once, but we should have sociologists in the room. When you introduce a new technology in a society 2,000 years ago, what happened? How did that change? How did behaviors change? How did relationship structures change? Did the geographic boundaries of where people live? What happened? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about like an enormous, the cascading effect is like both invisible and huge. So we should be thinking about like people that have studied this over all of time to tell us how we should be thinking about it, what frameworks we use, how we might go about measuring things like this. Anyway, I think that there's a lot that non-law, non-politics, non-tech experts can bring to the table here.
A question for you. Have you filled out the Ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
So I'd like to move on to talk a bit about cybersecurity now. And I'd like to ask, what are the risks and opportunities posed by AI in the world of cybersecurity? And how might this affect people's daily lives, especially as we talked about, as AI use becomes more and more common?
So cybersecurity, once upon a time, I thought that I had like a difficult definitional problem. And then now I'm like, oh, well, it's so much simpler than AI. But I mean, the definitional problem is like, what counts as a cybersecurity issue? If we're thinking of cybersecurity, we're thinking about maintaining the confidentiality, integrity, and accessibility of digital systems and information. But in cybersecurity, we also think about things like social engineering, espionage. There's a lot that comes into the fold. I mean, really, AI is just, maybe this is a lack of imagination, but I don't think it changes the nature of the game so much as it goes from playing in the backyard with water guns to giving people bazookas on both sides. All of a sudden, the stakes of everything are much higher. The tools are much more powerful. And unlike water guns, much harder to control unless you are one of the 10 experts in these tools. And the risk of harm if something goes wrong is much higher. So if you have deep machine learning based cyber defenses, what does that mean for a learned model to engage in cybersecurity defense? Is part of their learning going to mean that they engage in an offensive defense? Will they end up compromising the security or barriers of another system because they see that system as a threat? We don't know. From an offensive standpoint, obviously, it is very easy to deploy at scale a cyber threat, cyber attack, if you are running AI or using AI to use it. In cybersecurity, we've talked about dual use technologies for ages and ages and ages. And all technology is a dual use technology. But like, if you look at Mythos, it is absolutely understanding why everyone was so excited about having such an incredible model that can find vulnerabilities that people hadn't found for decades that might be critical, especially when my first paper was about open source and critical infrastructure. Like, we have serious vulnerabilities in our critical infrastructure. And so to fix those is very important. But if you have a tool that's built to find a hole and you give it to somebody that's using it to fix the hole, anybody else that wants to find the hole to exploit the hole doesn't need to use the system in really at all a different way to get their bad benefit from it. And it took, I think, less than a month for reports to come out that Mythos had ended up in the hands of unauthorized users. Such is the nature of a tech product. So the minute you release an extremely powerful defensive capability, you have now equipped bad actors with an offensive capability. But none of this is like a new dynamic. It's just been supercharged. It's possible that the use of AI would make investigations or detection of threats easier because you can look for an area that's using an anomalous amount of compute to see where this might be coming from. But on the flip side, if you have an adaptive AI that's very good at detecting this kind of anomalies, you'll also have, on the other hand, an adaptive AI that's very good at hiding this anomalous behavior. I felt like I just talked myself into a full circle, but I think the idea is it hasn't changed nature of the game. It's just kind of made it way more intense in all aspects.
And that's not unusual for new technology. It's sort of bringing up aspects that were already out there, but, you know, enhancing it. And so the water guns versus bazooka example, actually, I want to go back to what you were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, which is how the executive branch, the Trump administration, is using AI and what that means for the rule of law. Can you just talk a bit about the project you're working on and maybe explain to our listeners how the executive branch is currently or has been using AI in recent years?
So to start, I guess, with the thesis that I'm going to try to convince readers and I guess the audience of here, they'll have much less time to do so, is one that I feel is both deeply intuitive and also counterintuitive, best kind of thesis, which is, why is it that we do not want to automate away jobs in the executive branch that human beings used to do? And my thesis is because human beings are capable of dissent and artificial intelligence is not. And so when you automate away jobs that human beings used to do in the executive branch, you have now removed the possibility that somebody that was charged with executing on a presidential order, for example, might push back and say, are we sure that this is allowed? Or are we sure this is a good idea? Or I'm going to file a formal complaint that I think this is a bad idea. Or I'm going to report this to the media and to Congress because it's so bad. And I'm also going to just fully disobey or quit my job. All of those activities, I think, fall under the category of dissent, which is just a mindset of disagreeing with an order you have been given and an action that's going to make it harder introduce friction into the order being executed the way the executive wants it to be executed. So how's the executive branch automating? It's not a new phenomenon post-generative AI. This has been happening for many years. Disability benefits was an area where there was a fair bit of coverage when that shift happened. And it happened in a way that is being mimicked right now with AI. First, it wasn't even about the technology automating it. It was about moving from a standards-based system for determining who gets benefits and who does not, who's eligible for benefits and then renewal and who's not, which allowed for a great deal of judgment making and discretion at the street level, bureaucrat level, to eventually saying, we hate giving that discretion. It's leading to inaccuracy, inconsistency, inequality, like it's leading to all these bad things. So we're going to create strict rules, basically a yes, no checklist, and then you get your decision at the end. And once you're in that territory, automating those rules is actually fairly easy. And so we saw that shift there. And you might think, well, that's a good thing. We want disability benefits to be accurately, consistently, and transparently in terms of you build the system to document the checklist, it's going to document the checklist. That's a good thing. But what was lost there is these street level bureaucrats that were making determinations on eligibility were human beings interacting with human beings that came into their office. Repeat players, the same person at their local disability office and the same applicants would come in over time. The bureaucrat might say, you need more documentation. The person would come back. The bureaucrat learns a little bit more about this person's life, circumstance, context, things that's hard to document. Might be moved to waive a requirement for documentation if they have the discretion to do that. Try to find a loophole or an exception, use their discretion in a way that gets what they think the best possible outcome is. Obviously, I'm not saying bureaucrats are across the board, just like these saintly individuals that are always doing this in the best interest of the public. One, because nobody really knows what the best interest of the public always is across the board as like a binary. And two, there are flawed people everywhere. You could have a flawed day or just be a flawed person overall. But my thesis is not about all bureaucrats should do this all the time. It's that we need to maintain the capacity for it. I believe it was the Reagan administration. So around the 1980s, the president decided that they wanted to restrict the amount that we were distributing disability benefits. And they did this by saying, I'm changing the criteria for eligibility to renew benefits. So these are individuals that had benefits already, were going up for renewal. And based on the new criteria, people were just being denied across the board. And what does that mean? It means you lose your access to resources that are keeping you kind of fed, housed, and healthy. And the same bureaucrats, many of whom are guilty of being lazy or biased or incompetent or whatever pejorative thing that we have to say about them, individually, in a distributed way across the country, felt so uncomfortable implementing this on the ground that first they filed complaints, they slowed the process, they tried to use whatever way they could to not do it, but eventually they just started to disobey. And not collectively, there was no collective decision to do this, but it eventually kind of grew into so much of a wave of support for this disobedience that different state governors caught wind of what was happening. And then they ordered their state employees, because oftentimes federal benefits require the help of states and state employees to distribute. Those governors ordered their state employees not to enforce this new policy. And eventually the president's policy had to change. And so that's an example of what happens when policy meets the road and somebody says, this doesn't look right. And like, how powerful can it be for that capacity to eventually coalesce into something that is powerful enough to force federal executive policy change?
And staying on the U.S. government, you've written and spoken about the U.S. government's increasingly privatized and automated system of immigration enforcement. So how are AI tools fitting into this trend? How are they being used? And what does this mean for immigrants and for society more generally in the U.S.?
So they're being used for many things. Again, they're being used for benefits distribution, but they're also being used, for example, to read through all of the regulations in the Federal Registry and say, this one should be eliminated or this one should be changed. It's also being used to review grants for NIH. You know, right now, there's a lot of reporting that if it contains too many indicators of a preoccupation with diversity, equity, inclusion, it's not something that's going to get federal approval for grant money. But really, what one of my papers recently focused on the most is the way it's being used in the immigration enforcement space, which I think you alluded to. And this is an area where the federal government, Congress, gives the president law on what immigration law should be. Who gets to be let in, when, because they met what criteria, how many general guidelines. But then it is up to the president's discretion to enforce this. And part of what they're enforcing is, when has somebody lost the right to stay in the country as an immigrant? And in any context, law enforcement does not have the ability to go after every single case that is eligible for pursuit, prosecution, investigation, enforcement. And so they get to pick and choose. And some of the ways in which the government is picking and choosing which communities, which individuals, which offenses to prioritize is using private sector tools that involve AI. And so these private sector tools are prioritizing targets for enforcement. They're also using private sector tools for the actual enforcement. So this is surveillance technology, facial recognition, automated license plate readers. There are social media scraping and analysis tools. There are tools that take open source data. So for example, there's a lot of information about us that's available on the internet, not because some hacker broke into a system, but because like property deeds, voting records, there's just some stuff that's made publicly available in the domain. That information is being analyzed. And all of that's being done to say, not just who should we go after, but where are they? How do we find them? What's their gym membership? Like, what time do they go? Should we try to find them there? What's a hot spot where we're likely to find many people that we want to enforce against? And then once that individual target is apprehended, then they have tools that say, should this target be detained or not? And every immigration enforcement officer has the ability to waive detention. This person is eligible for detention, but for these reasons, we don't think they need to be detained. But because there's an algorithmic tool that's being used to make those recommendations, those tools specifications can be changed to say, we are never going to recommend that detention be waived. And so this paper is saying not just that the federal government is using these tools for these very key parts of immigration enforcement, but that it is important to note that those tools are built by private companies for whom the government is a customer. They're a contractor for the government, and the government is a big part of their revenue. And that these systems are all designed to work well together. And the reason that's relevant is because once you have these systems incredibly interconnected with each other and with federal and state and local databases and those systems, it's very hard to dismantle once it's there.
Thanks so much for that. Well, that's the end of my substantial questions. But I just want to say before we finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on or others are working on potentially that you think they might find to be of interest.
I mentioned 404 Media as an outlet. I just think folks should be following and supporting them. I think they're doing amazing work. I generally read pretty traditional news sources through newsletters online. And so I guess I don't have specific outlets, authors to recommend. My one thought is when I come across somebody posting an article written by someone or in a venue or on a topic that I would not ever naturally come across myself as a law and technology expert. For example, how did the wheel change family dynamics? And what does this have to say about AI? I don't even know if an article like that exists. I'm sure it does. That's, I feel like, been the most rewarding content to consume because it at least gets you out of the echo chamber of either being an AI doomer or an AI booster into somebody's expertise that your blind spots probably didn't even recognize was relevant. And so it gets like almost like you're a gamer. By venturing into that part of the world map, you have now exposed it. And so that is visible to you. You can go back there if you want. And that's really valuable.
That's great. Thank you. Well, we'll be linking to the 404 Project and all the other papers and resources we've talked about today. Just remains for me to say, Professor Chinmayee Sharma, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been such a pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on.
Professor Chinmayee Sharma is Associate Professor at Fordham Law School and a research affiliate at the Institute for Law and AI. And that's it for this episode of the Ballpark's AI mini-series. Thanks so much to Professor Chinmayee Sharma for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at @LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fattah. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, including last year's AI miniseries, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lsc.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lsc_us. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. Helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Centre or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!